Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento's cannabis industry in the spotlight as the city's push for equity and reinvesting in the neighborhood's hardest hit makes progress. But this comes as the city council tonight weighs pausing the industry in one district. We'll learn at what expense.
We've worked too hard. We've come too far. We've dedicated our time. So we lose all of that, or it gets put on hold.
And the Rhythm of Words takes center stage this weekend, the Sierra Poetry Festival, free of charge.
I think art is just so needed and important and essential in any times, but especially now after the year we've all had.
But first, infrastructure. It may not sound sexy at first, but California is very excited about a $2.2 trillion proposal. That's with a T from the Biden administration. And infrastructure has a broader meaning than you might initially think right off the bat. The proposal encompasses clean water, internet, even caring for those with disabilities, and the growing population over 65. And that's just a few. But there's an if and a big one at that, whether this proposal makes it through Congress. New York Times California correspondent Sean Hubler helped sort all of that out. I spoke with Sean yesterday and start off by asking her why she believes infrastructure is California's sweet spot.
California, I don't think people outside California or even many Californians understand how man-made the environment of California is. It's known for natural beauty. It's known Yosemite and Death Valley and these amazing natural landscapes. But California is in many ways man-made. The Central Valley is there because of an enormous network of dams and canals and engineering, and water is in Los Angeles because of the aqueduct, which we all watch Chinatown, so we know what that's about. And engineering is a big part of life here.
So in getting into this proposal, California is the most populous state, largest economy. So do we stand to get a larger slice of this $2.2 trillion proposal?
I know that California certainly hopes to and is likely to. A lot of the proposal is geared toward transportation, which you can imagine California has a huge stake in that. But it's also geared toward the kinds of underlying assumptions that California has had for generations, couple generations now, that you know we should be shifting more toward green technology, that we should be cleaning up the air, that we should be cleaning up the water, and that these kinds of projects are important and worth the money. So there will be a great deal of alignment between what the feds want to do with this money and California wants to do in this state if it's passed.
Is it significant to you that the governor actually spoke about this last week in a year that has really been dominated by the pandemic and stay-at-home restrictions and loosening of restrictions? Now we're talking about infrastructure.
And he was extremely excited, too. It was the most excited I think I've seen him all year for obvious reasons. He's right to be excited. This for California would be a big deal. It would be supercharging the policies that the state has really invested so much in that got kind of interrupted when the Obama administration left Washington and the Trump administration took over.
This proposed funding, I mean, it casts a pretty wide net. When I initially think of infrastructure, I think of buildings and roads, but this encompasses potentially internet, water, climate change, in-home caregiving. It's pretty far-reaching. Was that surprising to you? What stood out to you?
It was surprising. Well, one thing that stood out to me is often infrastructure programs are talked about in terms of just being an infrastructure program or a public works program. And the Biden administration kind of came right out and said it's a jobs program. The jobs are in the title. And that's really important because, particularly if what they want to do with this money is shift the national economy more toward green jobs, green infrastructure, they need to get labor on board organized labor on board, and especially in a place like California. And organized labor is concerned about that sort of thing because there are a lot of the better paying jobs in California are in the oil industry and fracking. And the labor unions here, they haven't always been aligned with the oil industry, but they have been more so in recent years. And that's a constituency that will have to come on board.
We are kind of talking in the hypothetical right now, because the $2.2 trillion is contingent on if the proposal actually passes. What are the chances of that?
Well, it's hard to know. Obviously, it's a 50-50, or, you know, it's a split Senate. Congress has got, you know, the House had a fairly narrow majority for Democrats. Republicans have already come out against, especially against the potential for a tax increase and the tax increases that the Biden administration wants to pass to pay for the bill. And so it will have, they'll have their work cut out for them. I'm guessing that there will be, you know, kind of a bit of a slog in Congress to get it passed. But that said, it does, this now seems to be the time for this. There's a lot of public, the public acceptance of, the pandemic, just to start with, has made people really aware of just how critical it is to have things like broadband that works, for example, for their kids in school, how important it is to have good in-home care for elders who were extremely vulnerable to COVID in nursing homes. And of course, in-home care, that's part of this care economy that's written into the bill. Even things like EV infrastructure, electric vehicles and electrification of transportation, that seemed to be sort of pie in the sky even as recently as the Obama administration. And in the last 4 years, it's become a lot more common and accepted as an idea for the country. And polls are showing that, you know, majorities of Americans like the idea of moving more toward EVs and cleaner cars and lower emissions. I think that there's going to be a lot more public demand for this than there might have been in earlier years, and sort of old arguments may not work as well.
Well, let's turn to education and that digital divide. As we all learned those hard lessons during the pandemic, you had in your article the PPIC, one in four public school students, did not have reliable internet access that absolutely is present in Sacramento and the surrounding counties. How will this money help close that gap?
There's quite a bit of money in there for broadband, building out broadband access and improving internet access generally across the country. California, believe it or not, you know, does need this kind of improvement. So there will be a lot of that in the state.
You know, you did touch upon in-home caregiving, and how does that play into infrastructure?
The argument that the administration uses is that in order for people to get back to work, we need to have the care infrastructure that allows people to hold down the jobs that they need to hold down. And certainly any parent who was trying to get their kids through remote instruction during the pandemic can attest to just how unbelievably complicated life can be if you don't have the infrastructure there to take care of to take care of older family members, to help you take care of your children, to they see that as an important aspect. There's also a graying economy, particularly in California by within the next decade is expected to have, if you can believe it, more, a higher proportion of its residents over 65 than Florida has. There are also a lot of, it's one of the biggest sectors, one of the growing sectors of the economy are home care workers, and they are an important constituency among organized labor. And so I can see the sort of a growing sector of the economy going in that direction. And I'm sure the administration can see that.
Over the past year, we all know and we've experienced and seen public transportation took a hard hit, from regional transit in Sacramento to BART in the Bay Area, even Amtrak, which is a reliable commuter between Sacramento and the Bay Area. How will this proposal help?
Oh, it's going to pump a lot of money into transit, way more than federal money than transit is used to getting. So this will do, Amtrak is, you can imagine, very, very excited. They have big plans for many routes and improvements of many routes.
What do the Sacramento and Central Valley stand to gain from this?
The Central Valley, there are water projects, for example, within this bill one of the really more sort of heartbreaking issues in the Central Valley is the areas where the water quality has been damaged, and where kids are drinking contaminated, drinking water, and cleaning that stuff up would be, critical. And there's also, with the drought coming, there are water quality, groundwater storage issues, water storage issues that would be also key to the Central Valley and funded.
Finally, we mentioned that this $2.2 trillion proposal needs to pass to become a reality. What does the timeline look like?
Fairly long. I think it's fairly, there's a I know that the Biden administration wants to get something passed, sort of this year, but, I have a feeling it's going to be a while to get everybody on board, as they say.
So the governor's going to have to carry his excitement from last week, potentially, into, 2022.
Yeah, I don't think you'll have much trouble. He looked pretty stoked.
And that is New York Times California correspondent Sean Hubler. Our conversation took place yesterday. Up next, an update on the city of Sacramento's cannabis program to reinvest in the neighborhoods disproportionately hit by the war on drugs, and why some who benefited from the program are now concerned their entrepreneurial hopes will be put on pause. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're taking a hard look at a program in Sacramento meant to level the playing field in a cannabis industry that has long come at the expense of lower-income communities of color. The Cannabis Opportunity, Reinvestment, and Equity Program, or CORE for short, was created by the city so that those with the most barriers to taking part in this green rush, as they call it, will have support, both through business education and financial means. But a challenge is, with a cap on permits in the city, the CORE program has had little space to turn graduates into business owners. That changed a bit last week. The city announced 10 new CORE participants were awarded the opportunity to apply for a storefront dispensary permit. Davina Smith is the program manager for the City of Sacramento's Office of Cannabis Management. Davina, thanks for helping us better understand this issue.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Davina, CORE started a couple years ago in the city. Can you remind us how someone qualifies for the program?
So So as you mentioned in your introduction, the CORE program was designed to help eliminate those barriers to preventing people who had been most impacted by the war on drugs to entering into the regulated cannabis industry. So in order to qualify as a CORE participant, one had to show that they had either been arrested or incarcerated in the city of Sacramento between 1980 and 2011. Or they had a close family member, a first degree family member who had been arrested or incarcerated. Or they could show that they lived in a low income household for 5 years in about 10 different zip codes in the city of Sacramento. And those zip codes corresponded with areas where disproportionate policing for cannabis violations had been tracked.
How long is the program and what do graduates receive in terms of support?
So the program is really a kind of take what you need kind of program. So there are certain benefits that the city provides, such as waived permit fees, expedited permit processing. And then the city has also paid for facilitators to provide that small business training, cannabis specific training, mentoring, different things like that. So some of the program people have been in the program for 12 weeks. Other times people are there just doing, you know, maybe they're involved in one particular class or another class. They're just there to get some consulting assistance with a particular issue they're having and trying to get their business up and running.
How many graduates have there been so far? And of those, how many now have up and running businesses?
Yeah, so the number of graduates has really increased exponentially in the last year, which is wonderful to see. So we have about 226 graduates of the program. That are in there. Some of them are still taking classes and utilizing services. Others are sort of on the other side. We currently have 14 businesses that are owned by CORE members. We have about 45 applications that are pending. And one of the things we've really been working on is trying to understand why there is that gap and to shorten that gap between the number of eligible people and those who are actually starting businesses.
In the latest announcement of CORE applicants who can now, they were awarded the opportunity to apply for cannabis permits, I had a little bit of a whiplash moment because you also explained that the city previously had a cap on permits and those were awarded years ago. CORE program participants had little opportunity to open a storefront even after participating in the program. Can you help unpack why a program for equity came after permits were taken up?
Yeah, and I think this is something, you know, that you really saw statewide. I think so long the struggle had been at a statewide level to get legalization of possession of cannabis, right, way back in 1996. And then it became, okay, well, how do you provide a legal supply chain for cannabis? You can possess it, but how do you legally access it? And then it became, how do you legally access safe cannabis that is tested and doesn't have some of the icky things that have been reported that, you know, cannabis can have on it, you know, and heavy metals and pesticides and things and mold and things like that. So I think there was a lot of focus on that. And it was really only, I think, in late 2016, 2017, that people started to turn to the idea of equity and, you know, what about those that had been most impacted by that war on drugs? And what about equity in that space? Statewide, the cannabis regulated landscape is still disproportionately male and white. And so I think it's a struggle that most jurisdictions are dealing with. And so here in Sacramento, you know, we had in 2015, we gave out the last permits for storefront dispensaries. And that was really based on people who had been operating there, you know, long-term. And so it was sort of, well, these folks are operating, we should be giving them the benefit of these permits. And at that time, things just sort of shut down for storefront dispensaries. So last year, the city council decided they were going to open that up. And they authorized 10 new storefront dispensary permits. And those were the first that had been available since 2015. So it's very exciting, I think, for all CORE applicants that they now have this opportunity. And I think it's really a way for Sacramento to achieve its goal of 50% cannabis business ownership being owned by CORE participants.
So the goal is 50%. Where are you in that process now?
We're far from it, and I think most jurisdictions are too. I will say that we're definitely getting there with the new numbers. You know, we will have there's currently, prior to the 10 storefront dispensaries, there was one dispensary that was owned by a CORE participant. And with these new, that'll be 11 out of 40 that are owned by core participants. So at least when it comes to storefront dispensaries, which is the most lucrative and sought after permit in the city of Sacramento, that's definitely a step in the right direction. We'll be going back to the city council in the next year to talk about how things have been going and to see if the time is right to maybe up that number or reevaluate the program further.
The SACB reported that your office is planning a survey to get a better picture of the city's cannabis industry. How so?
So we're going to be doing a study. We're commissioning a study to be done to kind of give a holistic look at the cannabis program here in Sacramento. I think we do a lot of things really right, and I think we can improve on a lot of things too. We want to look at other jurisdictions. We want to look at what we've been doing. We want to see where those gaps are. We want to see, you know, how has the industry evolved? Back when our ordinances were written to regulate the cannabis industry, there was a lot of fear about what would happen and what this would look like and would there be damage to neighborhoods. And what we've really seen both on crime, traffic, and neighborhood data is that those feared effects haven't manifested. So we're really looking at, you know, where should we be going with our program and what do we need to change to really get to where we want to be.
When looking at the 10 awarded applicants that were announced last week that can now apply for a permit, that was out of, I believe, a little over 80 applicants. What is a top score that allowed those 10 individuals to receive that award?
Yeah, so there were 102 applicants. So a little less than half of eligible core participants applied. I believe the top score was 382 out of a possible 400.
And what contributes to a top score? What do they need to achieve to get that?
So the RFQ that was out there, it had sections based on business readiness. So you had to submit business plan, you had to submit a budget, you had to submit a timeline for opening that really showed that you understood the regulatory requirements, the hurdles, and had a realistic goals on how that would be accomplished. And then there were other areas that asked the applicants to discuss, why they wanted to operate a storefront dispensary, what the impact of the war on drugs had on them on a personal level, who they really were and why they should be awarded this opportunity. So there was a mix of, you know, more pragmatic, practical business aspects and more personal. And those factors were really developed through community meetings with our core participants and getting information from them on what they wanted to be judged by, going to our city council and seeing what they wanted to see in the 10 new dispensary owners. And then, of course, talking with our city attorney about what we could and could not do.
Finally, what does the timeline look like for these 10 awarded applicants? When do you think they could have their business up and running?
Well, it's really exciting. And I think it kind of depends just how prepared they are to move forward. I think a lot of them are very prepared. I'm expecting, our first applications to start being submitted in the next probably month to 2 months. So it's a really exciting time here in Sacramento, and I'm happy to be here doing this program.
Davina Smith is the program manager for the City of Sacramento's Office of Cannabis Management. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about Sacramento's progress and challenges in making the city's cannabis industry equitable for those hardest hit. As 10 applicants get one step closer to their cannabis storefront, some existing core graduates are concerned their business will be put on hold. Tonight, the City Council will take up an item by Councilmember Sean Lalowey, representing District 2, proposing a moratorium on new cannabis permits, as well as expanding existing cannabis businesses, arguing his district has become saturated, asking for a 45-day moratorium, which could be extended up to 2 years. District 2 encompasses the neighborhoods including Del Paso Heights, Norwood, Hagenwood, Strawberry Manor, and Old North Sacramento. The council member did not respond to a request to be on the show, nor a follow-up, but I did speak with two core graduates yesterday in the council member's district. Both would be impacted. Here's part of my conversation yesterday with Labiba Rockman and Ashton Gibson. Now, before we start, there's some acronyms that are going to be thrown around. So RFQ means Request for Qualifications for a Storefront Dispensary Permit. CUP is Conditional Use Permit. And BOP is Business Operating Permit.
Just for a little bit of background, if each of you can tell us about your involvement in the Sacramento cannabis industry, and Labiba, we'll start with you.
I worked in delivery for about a year, so I have some experience in the cannabis industry, and I really, really enjoyed it. It was something that I had a great time doing. So when I found out about CORE, signed up, I said, wow, this is my opportunity to just run my own store. And I can employ people, give back to the community, and it's a win-win. So yeah, that's kind of how I got started with the whole cannabis thing. And I really enjoyed it.
And how about you, Ashton?
Well, I actually started the idea with wanting to break into the cannabis industry about 6 years ago. And I was really inspired by certain travels to like Amsterdam and Barcelona and seeing like the concept of dispensaries in a non-traditional way. So that really inspired me to want to break into the industry. And upon doing so, that's when I learned that Sacramento was at cap. And so I wanted to actually just at least get a foot in the door. And so I explored the opportunities with delivery. And so it was also at that time in 2018 when, you know, I was introduced to CORE, and you know, they've just been fully, fully supportive with just helping bridge the connection with certain resources and just different ideas, you know, across the board that I can utilize with getting into the cannabis industry. And so that was actually how I came upon, you know, like I said, a big interest in this industry.
How much of a game changer was CORE for your entrepreneur pursuits? Ashton, we'll start with you.
I'd say, I mean, it played one of the biggest roles, you know, just not, I think with any business, you know, it's already scary nonetheless to start a business, especially when you don't know much about the industry. You know, I knew I was definitely consider myself a cannabis connoisseur and, you know, knowing about products and knowing that the how to successfully run a business, but just the industry's in and outs and compliance, it was a little difficult. And so CORE, they played a huge role with just getting us in front of certain consultants. And again, just the full supply chain, you know, opening up to just different angles and what you can do. And just like I said, making that connection, what resources I didn't think I'd otherwise have, even with, you know, getting our applications and the assistance with that to also being able to apply for RFQ. You know, it's notable to add, it's extremely expensive to apply for non-refundable application. So to have them as that resource to, you know, even take care of that was a huge help for someone that's just getting into the industry.
Labiba?
Yeah, for myself, the entrepreneurial side, it was something that made me feel like I would still be able to be a mom. I have children, and it just, like, I don't know, it was just something that I knew I could do. And CORE provided that income or loan process, all of that helps us to go into business. If we don't have the money, we can't go in. It's very pricey to get a CUP. And the BOP, build outs, all of those things, CORE helps us navigate that system. And that is something that is priceless.
The city's intention behind CORE is striving for overdue equity, helping individuals within communities hardest hit, disproportionately hit by marijuana crimes over the decades. Given your graduates and have your own personal life experiences, can you help others understand why this program is so beneficial? Ashton?
She just hit right on. You know, it's extremely costly to get into this industry. And so to have that support, you know, even with consultations, you're talking in the onwards of 10 to 15,000. That's a lot of money to, you know, have. It's not a payment plan. It's what they want up front just to consult with someone, you know, about the ins and out, being compliant, how to properly fill out your BOP applications. And so to have that support, I mean, is golden. You know, it's something that if someone has the ability to take advantage of, they definitely should, you know, to the fullest extent.
Go ahead, Labiba.
One, we come from that disproportionated neighborhood that we've lost our fathers, brothers, mothers to the war on drugs. CORE allows us to go into business so that we could give back to our communities. That's what it's all about. taking that 1% and giving it back to our community so our community can be better. And without that program, a lot of us wouldn't be able to do that. So it's vital that we keep CORE, because it's going to allow, one, a lot of us who may not have went to college to have a business that is lucrative, that makes good money, and that can last throughout our family history. So, I mean, it's just vital that CORE stays around for the underprivileged.
And I like to even add on to that, you know, personally, I am a convicted felon for a drug charge that happens to be marijuana. And so, you know, with the opportunity that CORE provided to actually even assist in getting that expunged, which it was successfully done, you know, again, further allows me to, and myself and other individuals in that, in the same maybe situation, to, yes, have an opportunity, you know, entrepreneurship in this industry. Otherwise, that's something that would have definitely stifled me from doing a lot of things, just having a felony charge to begin with. And nonetheless, what they considered back then a drug charge, you know? And so that is vital. I mean, most people don't get those second chances to then, you know, be an owner and have equity in something that's so big today, you know?
Yes.
CORE was developed a couple of years ago, 2 to 3 years ago, in the city of Sacramento. When you look at the cannabis industry within city limits today, does it look equitable to you?
No, it does not.
Not at all. No. No.
And I mean, I think to easily just answer that, one would have to just, again, look at just the basic black and white numbers, you know, who makes up the ownership of all these cannabis businesses across the city, across the state, and you'll still see some large disproportionate numbers there, you know? And so, no, where's the equity? It should be right there. It's not.
And my question is, why is it okay for the wealthy who already have what they need to have more, but we can't have just a piece of what we actually need?
Why are entitled to.
Exactly. So I just feel that it's just not fair. Equity means fair and impartial. So, and it also means shares in a company. So where is the fairness, and how can we capitalize off of the education that we received, but now we can't use it?
So that leads us to the city council meeting and an agenda item in District 2 proposing a moratorium on new cannabis uses in District 2. If passed, that would effectively stop new cannabis permits as well as the expansion of existing production or dispensaries for at least 50 days, but up to 2 years if the council chooses to extend that. How will this impact your individual businesses? Ashton, I'll start with you.
Well, I currently have a building that's in District 2. And we're in right now process with our BOP. And so this building, I mean, we've had for a couple of years that's been paid on every single month. There's a lot of money that's had to go on that. I mean, we had to redo an entire sidewalk and a parking lot. That's a $40,000 job. So there's a lot of resources that are going to be lost, a lot of time, a lot of money, especially when that's money that, you know, you go into business and it, you know, it's that saying, it takes money to make money. So we go in with hopes that we're going to, you know, make these sacrifices and we're going to put all our resources together so that the outcome can be a successful business. And for that to no longer, or the possibility of that to fall short, you know, is really detrimental. And, it's, you know, it's unfortunate. And not only just, this is just off of my personal situation, but even for the other people, you know, who do want to get a foot in or who have started and want to expand, you know, that's to almost put a halt to, you know, your expansion as an entrepreneur, you know, that's also a little devastating. This is a community that you know, we want to serve, that needs to be served, that deserves to be served. There's cannabis businesses there that are obviously not doing their due diligence for the neighborhood responsibility, which is give back to these communities. And so to then have our opportunities halted where we can't see our communities thrive and grow, you know, through the channels of having equity in cannabis, again, is very unfortunate.
Because Ashton, you have, you just mentioned, you already have an existing permit, but you would like to expand, correct? And
absolutely.
That would impact your expansion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it makes it very, you know, we're there because number one, the cost, you know, it's a little bit better and you know, has a positive role on our entry into the industry with finding a building versus a lot of these other districts. And so, yeah, that definitely, and then just even the willingness, like I said, to find a landlord that is fully supportive and backing, you know, there's a lot of steps that go into this. It's not the same as an ordinary business where you go to a commercial property and say, hey, I want to have a business here. You know, there's certain already guidelines that we have to fall into with the compliance be in certain districts and cities and certain zones. So it's already difficult as is just to find that landlord willing. And for us and people of color, we find a little bit more of that support in District 2, where we make up obviously the most of the population there.
Labiba, how would this impact you if this moves forward at the city council meeting?
And it will directly affect me. I'm not up and running. So I would not be able to open up, or I would just have everything put on hold to open up, and anywhere from 45 days to 2 years. That's a long time, even 45 days when you have deadlines to meet for the loan process. And the city wants us to turn in our CUP funds by a certain date. So it slows things down. Also, I had found a location outside of District 2, but because it was only 3.5% in the city of Sacramento, I was pushed to District 2. So now that I'm pushed to the district, I found a location. There's the moratorium.
I would
imagine if I sign the lease, I'll be just paying for it.
That's what I was going to get to. I imagine, you know, you've already put in a sizable chunk.
Yes. I mean, we're already investing CUP costs, BOP costs. I mean, in everything, applications and different things, not outside of what CORE is covering.
Yeah. Your build outs.
Yeah. Our planning, you know, the just coming up with the blueprint. It takes a lot. The consulting to just do a business plan. Those things are not easy. And you take all your time and your effort and you put it all together and you have it perfect and you meet the point system and you do everything they ask, and you kind of get a slap in the face.
The argument when reading the agenda item from the District 2 council member who proposed this is that there's already an oversaturation in the district. The SACB has an article on this. They report that it has the second most permits in the city with others in the pipeline. What is your response to that, Labiba?
Oversaturation with wellness centers? No. I am a wellness center. I will be providing wellness to my community. It's not about just providing a recreational cannabis. I think it makes no sense. That's just my personal take on it.
I think also too, you know, time, I mean, you don't get that back, you know, and there were things that were a requirement for us to be, you know, honored as CORE graduates. That meant training, that meant passing actually those training classes to be certified, you know, and these are things you can't fast forward through the training clips. You have to sit there 3 hour clips, 4 hour clips, 2 hour clips, start to end. Then once they're done and you've shown that on their end, they see it. Then you have to take these tests. You have to pass these tests. If you don't, you're not certified. This is what allows you to then move on and be able to submit CUPs and BOPs. And so You know, all that time goes into that. And then, so what was the point? You know, you exhausted time and resources and city resources as well. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that say to these, to the people who, you know, are depending on the city who's accepted this funding to be able to put such a program through, and then you don't? Like, what is, you know, I mean, to me, it just seems a little unethical as well. You set millions of dollars to say, hey, we want to pour this into the equity program.
We've worked too hard. We've come too far. We've dedicated our time. We've done planning and sat, I mean, just so many things. I mean, just down to your getting your program together, your portfolio. You want to build and market your business. So you need to make a logo. You need a website. You build all those things now. You don't wait till you go into business. So we lose all of that, or it gets put on hold.
Again, that conversation with Labiba Rockman and Ashton Gibson was recorded yesterday. Sacramento City Council member Sean Lalowe represents District 2 and proposed the moratorium that will be taken up at tonight's City Council meeting. His office did not respond to a request to be on the show. Still ahead, time to pause, listen, and reflect. The Sierra Poetry Festival kicks off this weekend. A look at how the free festival is expanding, and a striking poem by their keynote artist. You can join the conversation too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. This weekend in the Sierra foothills, the Rhythm of Words will continue their tradition. The Sierra Poetry Festival kicks off Saturday and expands to a two-day format. The festival will be online again for the second year due to the pandemic, but performances will have live elements and the festival is free of charge. Joining us is Festival Director Eliza Tudor and Shelley Covert with the Nevada City Rancheria Nisenan Tribe. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, lovely to be with you today, Vicki, and super to be alongside Shelley Covert as well.
Morning.
Good morning. Well, Eliza, we'll start with you. In the last few years, poetry really seems to have taken off and become so much more accessible. Amanda Gorman, an overnight household name, the poet just 23 years old, really lit a match of profound creativity at Biden's inauguration, resonating across the world. Is there a larger message within this of poetry helping us navigate a society during challenging times?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's every reason that Amanda Gorman would have been selected as inaugural poet, and one of so young. We're desperately in need of a fresh voice, and you know, she's so capable, and her writing is so very beautiful. It's spoken to so many. In fact, when we at Nevada County Arts Council were working with our board of directors and our community on our page that describes our approach to racial and cultural equity, we included a line from The Hill We Climb by Amanda Gorman. In it, she says, "The new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it." And I think that kind of sums it up beautifully. When we started Sierra Poetry Festival 5 years ago, it was because we wanted to bring poetry in from the margins and to make it more accessible and meaningful and real for our otherwise disparate but rich literary community. And it seems to have done the trick. We weren't sure whether it was going to stick. It seems such an esoteric art, and yet it has, and it's been bringing people together for 5 years and now expanded into sort of a pretty much an international affair. So Yes, I think poetry speaks.
Well, Shelley, each year the Nisenan tribe, and am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Nisenan. Some say Nisenan. It's a dialect shift with the S to the SH.
Well, they play a significant role in welcoming audiences to the Sierra Poetry Festival. Can you tell us a little bit more about why?
The Nisenan are the original people from this area, the area where gold was discovered. And while the numbers are very small, the people that survived that tragedy in that time, we are still here in our homelands. And it's been incredibly, it's just raised our visibility so much with the social and racial justice movements that have been happening. People have been adopting land acknowledgments and asking themselves, upon whose land are we living today? And so having the Nisenan do the opening at the Poetry Festival, we are able to do that welcoming that's very traditional. In the old days, we would have welcomed anyone into our territory. Because if you don't welcome people in a good way, people can get sick. That's our belief. And so being able to welcome these poets from all over who are bringing these incredible messages to our community is something that I'm really proud of. And I'm proud of Nevada County Arts Council for being one of the first to step up and adopt this way of inviting the Nisenan to always be present in whatever works that we're doing.
And there's another reason that we love to have Shelley with us, and that she herself is an artist. She writes lyrics. She's a lyricist. She's a songwriter. She has a band. She's a musician.
pre-COVID days, right?
You're still doing it at home.
Oh, I'm sure that has carried you through the pandemic for sure.
Yes,
well, finally, I mean, this is bringing us to, we're going to save the final minutes of the show for the keynote poet, Tanaya Wagner. Can you just briefly introduce her to us?
Would you like to do that, Shelley, or would you like me to take the lead with that?
I would love you to. I would just like to say how proud I am of our Native American women who are really taking stage in so many different ways today. And it just makes me feel so good to be able to invite her.
So in introducing Tanaya, I would say we have over 40 presenters, poets and presenters from across the nation, from all over North America, including Canada, and into Europe and across about 5 different continents. We have poets joining us from as far afield as Palestine, Rwanda, Siberia, London. But what's special about Tanaya is that she represents truly our land from across the nation. She's an author, singer, songwriter, poet, speaker, educator. She comes from an intertribal lineage of Southern Ute, Pyramid Lake, Paiute, and Duckwater Shoshone nations. And she has an incredible literary lineage. So it's really, we couldn't be more delighted. It was Joy Harjo, the US Poet Laureate, who introduced us in person. And she comes with the recommendation from Joy Harjo to be our keynote at Sierra Poetry Festival. So we're very happy.
Thank you, Eliza Tudor and Shelley Covert, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vicki.
We are going to end today's show with this weekend's keynote artist, Tanaya Wagner, performing Becoming a Ghost.
Becoming a Ghost. Ask me about the time my brother ran towards the sun, arms outstretched. His shadow chased him from corner store to church where he offered himself in pieces. Ask me about the time my brother disappeared. At 16, tossed his heartstrings over telephone wire, dangling for all the res dogs to feed on. Bit by bit, the world took chunks of my brother's flesh. Ask me about the first time we drowned in history. 8 years old during communion, we ate the body of Christ with palms wide open, not expecting wine to be poured into our mouths. The bitterness buried itself in my tongue, and my brother never quite lost his thirst for blood, or vanishing for more days than a shadow could hold. Ask me if I've ever had to use bottle caps as breadcrumbs to help my brother find his way back home. He never could tell the taste between a scar and its wounding, an angel or demon. Ask me if I can still hear his exhaled prayers. I am still waiting to be found. To be found, tell me why there is nothing more holy than becoming a ghost. Thank you.
And that is poet and artist Tanaya Widener. The Sierra Poetry Festival is this weekend online and is free of charge. That's it for Insight today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight or catch us anytime wherever you get your podcast, Spotify included. Join us tomorrow when we talk about how nursing homes have fared through the pandemic and how more people relied on religious faith during the pandemic. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Cap Radio's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munoz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.